Good morning. I'd like to welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals. Thank you for being here this morning. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my left is Justice Dana Womack. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and I'm Bonnie Sutterth. I'm the Chief Justice of the Court. And it's my understanding that everyone has checked in and is ready to proceed. But before we do that, I'll ask the clerk to please call the case.
The court will now call number 0225214CB, Urban Fund 3 LP versus Blackbird Operating East and others. May it please the court. Mr. Philip Vickers will argue for appellants. For the appellees, Mr. Robert Bartavedian will argue for Blackbeard Operating. Mr. Mark Gibson will argue for Legacy. And Mr. Lloyd Lim will argue for Marathon.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court, and I'd like to begin by introducing my co-counsel, Roger Claxton, here on behalf of the appellants. And I also want to mention that my colleague and co-counsel, Ralph Duggins, sends his apologies. He can't be here. He had a substantial back surgery last week that was already scheduled, and so this case is important to him, and he is sorry he's not here. The court should reject Blackbeard's legally impermissible effort to offload Blackbeard's own contractual obligations to third parties. What Blackbeard seeks is extraordinary risk shifting for which Texas law demands clear and express language in the party's contract, language that is absent from the Blackbeard Urban Agreement, and in fact, that agreement contradicts what Blackbeard's attempting to do. Now, there are multiple routes to reversal, but this court only need agree with Urban on one of them. Today, I really want to focus on the most straightforward paths. And that's
before you do, I have one question that I've read all the briefs. They're excellent, by the way. I really appreciate that. And I really read it for substance. But then this thought came to me yesterday, and I didn't even flesh it out. But I'm going to ask both sides to address it, unless you've got a quick answer for me. Why is it this at the 15th Court of Appeals?
This case started before, I believe, the business courts were around, and I don't think anybody's asked that question on our side. Maybe the other side has thought about it, but it just hasn't come up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for asking.
Go ahead.
The two grounds I want to focus on today are what the contract says, what does his explicit language say, and then what it doesn't say. First, about what it says. Blackbeard has argued that there are concentric circles of broad and sweeping defense and indemnity language, which it says hold Urban to defend the upchain defendants. Now that image is striking, it's even almost pretty, but the argument that Blackbeard makes based on that graphic is atextual, because it fails to place the party's carefully defined words in their proper context in what is a heavily documented deal. This court's task, of course, is to examine and give effect to all the language in the contract, harmonizing it so that all provisions are given effect and none are rendered meaningless. The more complete image, we would argue, is, Your Honors should have a brief handout, is this first image, which shows that those concentric circles have a deep carve-out of specific exclusions that are not reflected in Blackbeard's argument, and that affect the definitions of assumed obligations and conveyed interests. We would argue the second page of the handout, both of these charts were in our reply brief, but the second page is the same one, summarizes the nested set of definitions that are doing the work here. To kind of set the stage, the parties' agreed definitions allocate risks globally between those that were assumed by Urban, those are the ones in green on the left-hand side, and those risks that were retained by Blackbeard, retained obligations. And as you can see, and I think the parties all agree on this, the assumed obligations are defined by reference to the conveyed interests. Those are the assets that the parties were exchanging in this deal. And the definition of conveyed interests is defined to encompass the applicable contracts. So it was part of the intention that there would be contracts conveyed or assigned as part of this transaction. But from each of those terms were excluded the definition of retained obligations, which is defined to encompass the excluded assets, so the assets that were taken out of the deal. And that term is defined by reference to excluded information. Each of those terms has lengthy definitions, but the critical part of that term is that it includes contracts whose change in ownership or transfer is prohibited and for which no consent to transfer had been received.
Is it consent to transfer, or is, as the appellees focus on, the assignment language? It's an anti-assignment provision. What's your position on whether these were assignments, assumptions, transfers, or does it matter?
As you can tell from the chart, this agreement was designed so that the applicable contracts would be part of the conveyed interest, so therefore conveyed and assigned. And Blackbeard even says this early in its brief on the, I believe it's pages 20 and 25. They say Urban directly acquired these contracts, that these contracts are applicable contracts. But the point here is if they fall into this definition, they are not. They're taken out of the definition of conveyed interests and therefore not assumed or assigned. They fall into the same category. So the idea is a contract, if it's applicable, you would be taking assumed obligations with the applicable contract. But if it falls outside the definition of an applicable contract, it's not a conveyed interest. And the way the definitions work, it's also among the retained obligations. So our position is it doesn't matter. We agree that there was no assignment, but there was no assignment because the contract agreed that there would be no assignment. And that's why this term does work both on assignment and assumption. It's kind of, those are how, that is the party, the deal the parties did. There's one argument that the parties make, which they don't cite any case law for it, and actually is contradicted by the law, which is that, well, if there had been some assignment, you wouldn't then hold the parties in the chain liable, as is going on here. Presently, Blackbeard has been fulfilling obligations to Legacy, and then Legacy has in turn passed it on. But one of the cases we've cited, Seagull Energy, it's on page 70 of our brief. We didn't cite it for this proposition, but it actually says that a party can't escape obligations under a contract by assigning it. When you've assigned the contract, the general rule is the party who assigns it remains liable, with perhaps the assignee, to the original obligee. So the fact that the other parties are standing in and answering doesn't have anything to do with the questions before the court. What really comes down to is, what did the parties say? What did they agree to? So in addition to the defined terms here, there's additional language which we've discussed in our brief that also expressly puts these risks and liabilities on the Blackbeard side of the ledger. And that's section 13.3. That's the indemnity clause that says only the seller indemnified parties, that's Blackbeard and its affiliates, are entitled to an indemnity. Section 13.8 is an additional clause which says any indemnity not provided in 13.3 is waived. What that means is it doesn't affect what 13.3 says. It doesn't affect the indemnity clause. What it says is, looking at every other term in this contract, if there's any place somewhere else where some indemnity is popping its head up that would require Urban to do anything other than indemnify Blackbeard, if it's not express, it's waived. In a sense, I've made reference already to Texas law requiring express language for an indemnity. What 13.8 does is it kind of creates its own law of the contract. It says an indemnity to be provided under this agreement must be express. And then 15.11 we've also cited, which is the no third party beneficiaries. I don't really understand how Marathon or Legacy could claim that Urban is contractually obligated by virtue of the Blackbeard agreement to defend them without them becoming third-party beneficiaries of that agreement. So in my view, 1511 makes clear what the result is. Urban's only obligation is to defend and indemnify Blackbeard, but not for its contractual indemnity obligations, because those which would therefore somehow require it to defend these other parties. The parties' agreement was pretty clear on that. So now, that's what the contract says. What does it not say? An attempt to offload one's own contractual indemnity obligations, as I mentioned earlier, constitutes extraordinary risk shifting. And for that reason, Texas courts have insisted that express notice is necessary to hold someone responsible for what's sometimes called pass-through indemnity. It's the very same principle that animates the express negligence rule. It arises out of courts' concern about parties trying to offload more risk than their partners thought they were acquiring under a contract. And it's really just an expression of the simple rule that courts are to construe indemnity contracts strictly in favor of the indemnitor. Now, in this, you'd search in vain for any reference to express or clear language by any other party that they've identified that would show that Urban agreed to indemnify Blackbeard for its own contractual indemnity obligations. There's no reference to that anywhere. There's not even a reference to the Marathon Agreement or to the Legacy Agreement, the upchain agreements. And this is not an argument that says magic words are required. We're not talking about magic words. It actually is simple, and an example is in the record. It's the Legacy Agreement with Blackbeard. When Blackbeard bought these assets from Legacy, it agreed in the Assumed Obligations Clause not just to assume obligations arising from the conveyed interests, but also specifically obligations that Legacy owed to Marathon. It identified the Marathon agreement and specifically referenced it. So in that case, that contract did expressly require Blackbeard to assume obligations to Marathon.
Since you mentioned Marathon, how do you respond to their argument that you did not negate all the possible grounds for summary judgment, namely the standing and collateral estoppel arguments?
There's a couple responses to that. The first is under Rule of Appellate Procedure 38.1, Urban's issue requesting reversal and rendering on all the cross motions itself covers every subsidiary issue. And so we would say that covers the subsidiary issues that were argued on, for example, the bankruptcy question. The second is that this is an appeal from cross motions for summary judgment. And the cases discussing that say that the courts that all of the summary judgment issues, evidence, and arguments, including, in our view, collateral estoppel and standing, are before the court. When both sides move for summary judgment, according to the Mann case, the trial court grants one motion and denies the other. It says, we review the summary judgment evidence presented by both sides and determine all questions presented. So what we have here are these cross motions for summary judgment. And then we also believe that Urban is entitled to respond to Marathon's argument on the issue then, given that law, when they've raised it in their appellee's brief. Then we're entitled to respond to it in their reply. That's the argument on that. I'd be happy in the few minutes I have left to address any other questions, maybe 5.5, or if there's some other issue related to the case that I haven't addressed to your satisfaction. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to butcher this name, Mr. Vartabedian.
Vartabedian.
Okay.
We have some bench books with just a handful of things. May she approach, Your Honors?
Thank you.
And you've provided this to the other side?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
The bench book has just a few demonstratives, and it has a copy of the PSA with tabs on it in case you'd like to flip through the provisions we're most likely to discuss. May it please the Court, Your Honors. I plan to focus today on what I think is the dispositive issue in the case, and that's the definition of excluded information. There are a lot of issues, a lot of arguments, but I think, as clear from the reply brief filed late last week and from the argument of counsel, it really all comes down to excluded information. If excluded information encompasses all the rights and obligations arising from contracts that include PSAs in Urban's chain of title, then I think Urban wins. And that's the point of Urban's graphic here, that the one that looks like, a dying Pac-Man, because they cut a slice out of the different circles of obligations for retained obligations, excluded assets, and excluded information. But if you read the briefs carefully, the only reason they're saying it's a retained obligation is because they're saying it's an excluded asset. The only reason they're saying it's an excluded asset is because it's excluded information. That argument is the one that does all the heavy lifting for Urban in this case. If, on the other hand, excluded information is merely a reference to the types of records and documents and information that buyer didn't receive in this transaction, then Blackbeard and the other appellees should prevail. And in contract construction, the text, of course, is the key to everything. But in order to understand the text, you have to understand the text in context. As this court said just 3 months ago in the Liberty Centerpoint case, the rule of strict construction does not require you to fabricate nonsensical ambiguity. As the Supreme Court has said over and over again, the circumstances present when a contract is entered into need to be considered, the particular business activity sought to be served, and the realities the words were meant to address. You have to consider excluded information in context. And when you do that, you'll see excluded information cannot perform nearly the amount of work that Urban wants it to perform in order to allow Urban to shirk its broad obligations. The general structure of the deal is important to consider also. This was a transfer of the risk bundle as well as the transfer of the properties related to the Louisiana assets. The PSA sets up a scheme where there are assumed obligations on one hand and retained obligations on the other hand. And the assumed obligations go with the buyer, go with Urban. The retained obligations stay with Blackbeard. And if you walk through the PSA, it's not an accident what's retained and what's assumed. The property goes with a party, and that same party retains the obligations. And that's how the structure works, big picture. In our bench book, there's the first demonstrative, you can see, walks through this concept and shows you exactly how that obligation scheme works, going from assumed obligations on the left and down through retained obligations on the right. It's a handy chart. I'm not going to go over the entire thing because these are all issues that have been briefed by both parties. But that's the general structure of the deal. Specifically, when it comes to excluded information, the question here, as I said, is what is excluded information? Is it so broad as to mean anything that is mentioned with excluded information, the rights and obligations associated with it? If not, then what we're talking about here, these PSAs, they would be applicable contracts related to conveyed interests. And therefore, they would be assumed obligations. The only argument that Urban has to the contrary is that these are somehow excluded information. So let's take a look, if you can look in the bench book, to zero in on this provision. And if you want to go to the tab in the PSA and look at it in the entire PSA, it's the middle tab that says excluded info, excluded information. But if you take a look at the way excluded information was briefed by Urban, there's heavy use of ellipses every time they talk about excluded information, and for good reason. If you look at the appellate brief at page 63 and the reply at 14, they cite excluded information defined as, in quotes, any contract, ... whose ownership and transfer is prohibited. And then it goes on with the rest of the sentence. The ellipses skipping out of the middle of subpart A in excluded information. When they address this in their reply at page 18, they say excluded information encompasses contracts. In addition to information, it expressly covers contracts, licenses, and master service contracts. Again, ellipses. And what you can see below is the part that the ellipses are knocking out explains the context of what we're talking about here. We're not talking about contractual obligations and contractual rights. We are literally talking about the records and the documents themselves and copies of those documents. In order to figure that out, you don't need to go beyond the plain text. Just look very carefully at this definition. Start and look at the term that is being defined, excluded information. It doesn't get much plainer than that. We are talking about informational assets, not property assets, not rights and obligations. We are literally talking about information based on the term that's being defined. Then look at subpart A and look at the words surrounding any contracts. The series goes on, and there's no meaningful addressing by Urban of our Nostra Aesosis argument, that we say you need to look at this in the context, you need to look at its companions to figure out what it means. Urban just makes the bald assertion that we're using subjective intent when we make those arguments. We're not. This is a very clear rule of interpretation embraced over and over and over again in Texas courts. You look at the surrounding words to figure out what they meant by any contracts. And it says books, records, files, maps, information, data, software licenses, including radio licenses, whatever a radio license is, and copies thereof. And I think the end of that sentence is particularly important. We're talking about a physical contract with information on it. And that's why it's not the rights and obligations that they're worried about. They want that original contract, and they want copies thereof to be included in this excluded information. And then it goes on to talk about it's items like this, information like this, where you needed to pay a transfer fee or you needed to get a consent to assign, and you didn't do that. In other words, this is information that is not going from Blackbeard to Urban. It's excluded information, and therefore, because that information is not going from Blackbeard to Urban, Urban doesn't have any responsibilities or obligations related to that property. If you go down into the broader clauses, it talks about things like work product. It talks about proprietary information. This is information that's not going to go from Blackbeard to Urban. And because it's not going to go from Blackbeard to Urban, there's no obligations associated with it. Master service contracts is modified by conveyed interests and other assets of sellers. In other words, this is a contract that has information that includes things that aren't being conveyed. It's other assets of Blackbeard. If you look quickly, I'm going to start eating into my co-counsel's time. But the records provision that we talk about at 2.1 is juxtaposed with excluded information in the excluded assets. Excluded information is only mentioned three times in the PSA. And the third and final time it's mentioned is in excluded assets, where it says, notwithstanding the definition of records, any excluded information. That juxtaposition makes it clear. Records are the records and information that go from Blackbeard over to Urban. Excluded information are the records and information that don't go, and therefore there's no liability associated with it. This, as briefed, also conflicts with 5.5 with regard to consents. The PSAs, there's no question the chain of the documents in the chain of title, that's how Urban got its interest in these properties. They're not saying, you know, we don't have a hole, we have holes in our chain of title. They're saying we got the properties, we just didn't get the assets. And they're using this excluded information provision to do all the work for them. If excluded information is interpreted to be what it is, merely records and information, then Urban's arguments all fall apart, which is why I think that's the dispositive issue in this case. Happy to answer any questions that your honors have. Otherwise, I'll cede my time to my co-appellees.
I do have the same question to you about the 15th Court of Appeals.
It was, the case was filed in 2022, and
but the appeal was filed in 2025.
That's correct. So I think probably the parties could have sought the 15th Court of Appeals if they wanted to, but I guess everyone decided they wanted to be here.
Well, we're honored.
Thank you, Your Honor.
My concern, however, is that it needs to go to the 15th Court of Appeals because it is a case that should be filed there, not here. And I'll ask everybody to, unless I hear something that convinces me that I'm not on the right track here, I'll ask all parties to submit a letter is fine, something post-argument to address this concern of mine.
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And you are Mr. Gibson?
That's right, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I have just two quick points to make this morning. The first is about Legacy's bankruptcy discharge. The second is about Urban's argument that Legacy purportedly tried to assign its obligations to defend and indemnify Marathon to Blackbeard. Now, as for the bankruptcy point, Urban spills a lot of ink arguing that Legacy's obligations to Marathon were discharged in the bankruptcy. But the court need not and should not resolve that issue, because even assuming there was a discharge, that discharge does no good to Urban. The bankruptcy code, Fifth Circuit case law, and Judge Isker's own opinion in the underlying case here all make clear that a bankruptcy discharge does not eliminate the entire debt. It simply eliminates the debtor's personal liability for that debt. But the underlying debt lives on, and in this case, that underlying debt was separately assumed by Blackbeard in 2015 and ultimately separately assumed by Urban in 2018 before the bankruptcy even took place. So Urban simply does not benefit from a bankruptcy discharge that runs solely in favor of Legacy. Now, it's also the case that the district court correctly granted summary judgment as for my clients, and that is true regardless of this bankruptcy discharge issue. If there was a discharge, then obviously Legacy pays nothing and is entitled to summary judgment. But again, it simply doesn't matter whether there was a discharge, because nobody in this case disputes, and the district court here determined that regardless of the bankruptcy issue, Blackbeard again separately assumed those obligations from Legacy, so Legacy pays nothing and is entitled to summary judgment. And you don't have to take my word for that. This is the exact analysis that Judge Isker laid out in his opinion. So whatever else the disposition may be in this case, the court should affirm summary judgment as to Legacy at a minimum. Now, as for the assignment issue, there simply was no assignment of contractual obligations from Legacy to Blackbeard. Instead, what happened was Legacy and the obligations to Marathon were placed with a wholly owned subsidiary of my client, Akin Bean. The membership interests were then acquired by Blackbeard in a membership interest purchase and sale agreement. This was an equity sale. This was not an assignment of contractual obligations. Plus, the only party with standing to complain about any purported violation of the assignment provision in the Marathon Legacy PSA is, of course, Marathon. That provision is for the benefit of Marathon. But Marathon has expressly waived any objection to any anti-assignment clause violation. So Urban, a third-party stranger to the Marathon Legacy Agreement, cannot invoke that agreement's anti-assignment provision to somehow try to wriggle out of its own separate contractual obligations to Blackbeard. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lim?
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. Your Honor, with regard to your, Justice, with regard to your question about waiver, Urban's arguments with regard to collateral estoppel and anti-assignment were waived because they were not raised briefed in Urban's appellate brief. Rather, Urban only addressed those two issues in his reply brief after Marathon argued waiver in its appellee's brief. The Fort Worth Court of Appeals recently acknowledged that an appellant may file a reply brief addressing any matter in the appellee's brief. However, the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure do not allow an applicant to include in its reply brief a new issue in response to some matter pointed out in the appellee's brief, but not raised in the appellant's brief. And that's Asta Partners LLC versus Potswani, which is at 2021 Westlaw 5133888 at page 17. Marathon wholly agrees with the discharge arguments just made by Legacy. And I'd like to point out two recent cases on point on this issue. The first one is In Re Dynamics Offshore Resources NS LLC, which is at 2025 Westlaw 1651901 at page 3, where the Fifth Circuit noted that a discharge in bankruptcy is neither payment nor extinguishment of debts that are discharged. It's merely a bar to enforcement of that debt by legal proceedings. The other one is the United States Supreme Court's case in Harrington versus Purdue Pharma, which is at 603 U.S. 204, decided in 2024, where the United States Supreme Court held that third-party releases are prohibited by the Bankruptcy Code because such releases are tantamount to granting third-party releases and discharges, as we're seeing being attempted in this case. The other issue that I want to address is Urban's argument that the legacy plan of reorganization somehow extinguished the debt. So not just discharged it, its personal liability, but wholly extinguished the debt. That specific argument was rejected by the Fifth Circuit in Dynamic Offshore Resources. The Fifth Circuit specifically held that terms like satisfaction, settlement, release are not ambiguous, that they clearly connote a bankruptcy discharge under 524 of the United States Bankruptcy Code. Again, this is 2025 Westlaw 165901 at page number 4. In reaching this conclusion, the court explained that it has long series of precedent or has rejected similar arguments, specifically in the case of Snyder, which is at 539 Fed Second 487, page 490 at footnote 3, where the circuit specifically rejected a guarantor's argument that the inclusions of the terms canceled and extinguished, along with the term discharge in a plan, annihilated the debt. The court said no, the debt remains and can be enforced despite the language in the plan.
Thank you. Mr. Vickers?
Yes. Your Honor, this agreement should be enforced as written and not as Blackbeard or others wish it had been written. There is nothing in the record to show what the context is or anything outside the terms of the agreements. Specifically, and there's no mystery what's required. What could have been done is what was done in the legacy Blackbeard agreement. The majority of Blackbeard's argument today has been that the term excluded information doesn't mean what it appears to mean. And what I heard counsel say is that in essence, all excluded information is copies of documents. I don't understand, and I didn't hear an explanation of why this agreement would exclude copies, but only copies of documents that require consent to transfer in which no consent was received. There's also been no discussion either in Blackbeard's brief and none today of what document the word contract could refer to. Because all the other examples that have been given are already otherwise expressly described outside, licenses or these master services agreements. You haven't seen one example of what the word contract in the definition of excluded information could conceivably mean other than what it appears to mean, which is a contract that requires consent and for which no transfer consent has been received. I believe our reply brief probably adequately handles the discussion of Section 5.5, but 5.5 in its context is plain that what it deals with is when there are, first off, 5.5b2, which is the provision that Blackbeard refers to the most. It doesn't mention the word contracts in it. It's defined based on the definition of conveyed interests, which, as I argued earlier, by the time you get to conveyed interests, it's already excluded these contracts. But what 5.5 is doing is saying when you're making this transaction, there are going to be assets that are listed on schedules that have allocated values. Those are the well bores and leases. The parties allocated values in schedules. And what 5.5 says is if there's a provision in some document that prohibits the assignment of that asset without consent, is it a hard consent requirement or a soft consent requirement? If it's a soft consent, that is consent cannot be unreasonably withheld, then the agreement says that asset is transferred and there's no change in the purchase price. If there's a hard consent where an attempt to transfer the asset would actually jeopardize the title to the to the asset, then it says no, it's excluded from the conveyed interests. And the purchase price is adjusted. So 5.5 is not about contracts at all. It's about the transfer of these assets to the parties allocated value to. And Blackbeard doesn't and hasn't given any explanation for how its interpretation of 5.5b2 wouldn't affect all contracts and totally read out of the definition of excluded information what it says, contracts for which consent is required but none has been obtained.
Do you agree that if we don't agree with your interpretation of what excluded information means, that that the whole case turns on that?
No. And that's the second thing I argued earlier, Your Honor, which is what's clear is that this contract does not have the express language required to indicate this intention for Urban to take on Blackbeard's own separate contractual indemnity obligations. So that's what the law requires. This court's opinion in Neighbors Drilling takes that head on. It says that the language needs to be explicit and make clear that the contracting party is agreeing to take on indemnity protection. The footnote 5, this court described three different ways that this can be done. The only one that Blackbeard has referred to is the first, which would be to require indemnity protection for any contractual liability to third parties. But its argument is that, well, this broad assumption language necessarily means that we're requiring indemnity language, which there's no explicit language that actually says indemnities are being passed on. So none of the Neighbors Drilling provisions are satisfied. And what's really important in Neighbors Drilling is that was a case where there was an overall scheme that was intended by the parties. That scheme was that subcontractor would be responsible for any injury its employees suffered, regardless of who the employee sued. But what the court said is indemnity agreements do not always accomplish their intended purpose, and the court's job is to actually dig into the language. And so this court found there that there was no express language making this pass through indemnity. So whatever their intent might have been, it was not satisfied by the agreement.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your arguments here today. They were very helpful, and I will once again say the briefing was excellent in this case. We appreciate that, too. This case is scheduled to be submitted today, but I'm going to hold off submitting it until both sides address my concern that this should be in the 15th Court of Appeals and not the 2nd Court of Appeals, and I'll let you do that by letter as quickly as you can get it to me. But other than that, we are concluding the oral argument for today, and you're free to go. Thank you.